Okay, we are recording, so let me start by saying, Andrew Johnson, thank you for joining me in the trenches.
Thanks for inviting me, Jeremy.
We've been trying for a while, haven't we?
We have, yeah. Your messages kept going to spam, so I didn't know that you'd sort of set things up and the responses lost, and it was a bit of a nightmare. But yeah, here we are, thankfully.
So this is a conversation I've been wanting to have for a very long time. It's very suppressed, isn't it?
Yes, a lot of this stuff is suppressed, and not only is it suppressed, but it's been significantly muddled up. So, you know, some of it comes out, but then it gets jumbled up and mixed up with other things so that it becomes a bit confusing, and therefore some people can't follow it. You know, so that's one of the problems.
Just quickly, what is your background?
Well, my background really is in software development and software engineering, essentially. That's where I've done most of my professional work. I went to Lancaster University in the UK, and I did a degree in computer science and physics for 3 years. I didn't do any advanced degrees, I didn't go to the levels of some of your other guests. But I did go into engineering, essentially, and worked in software development and engineering for about 20 years. And over that time, I developed an interest in teaching and education. I developed an evening class in C programming. C is a sort of medium-level programming language which is used in a lot of embedded systems and microelectronics, which is primarily the area that I worked in. So I've worked in lots of different areas of that, telecommunications, process control. I did work in Canada, USA, Italy, Japan, and a couple of other places, a few places in the UK. And that was all basically with microelectronics stuff. But since then, I've done websites, databases, you know, and I can sort of turn my hand to most things. And I currently work for the Open University doing distance learning tuition, which involves occasional presentations to students about 4 or 5 a month, something like that, one or two a week. And then I have to mark students' work as well and assess that and grade it. Based on the guidelines that we're given to assess with. So that's how I earn my living. I don't earn a living from writing books about 9/11 or directed energy weapons or anything like that. I have written 7 books, and you can get them all free for download from checktheevidence.com. So you can log on there and get those free of charge, or you can get paperback versions from Amazon and probably places like Barnes & Noble, because I've got an on-demand printer which links into those sites, and I sell them more or less at cost, so you know you can get those reasonable prices for books if you want them. You can get them all from checktheevidence.com. I'll ship them out to you if you don't want to get them from Amazon or something. So and I got interested in this stuff, won't spend too long on the background, in 2003 when I started looking at all the UFO stuff, UFOs and alien type stuff. I started to revisit that back in 2003. Then I sort of looked at 9/11 and investigated that, got involved with a lot of that research. And then that led me into contact with one of your other earlier guests from 2 or 3 years ago, Dr. Judy Wood. And it was, of course, her research which revealed that some type of energy weapon was used to destroy the World Trade Center, and that was one of the topics, I think, that you wanted to touch on tonight, and some of the background to that, I think, was what you'd expressed an interest in. So there we are.
Okay, so let's go back to basics. What are directed energy weapons?
Well, again, like a lot of these acronyms, if you look at the actual words, they are relevant. So a directed energy weapon uses energy. So it doesn't have a projectile, and it doesn't, like, for example, use fire, like a flamethrower. That's not really a directed energy weapon, although, of course, you could argue that fire is a source of energy, etc. So if you can, we won't get into that. So really, directed energy weapons are directing energy at a target to cause damage or cause destruction or kill people, basically. And these have really started to be developed in the white world, sort of, I think, since the end of the Second World War. I think it was realized, for example, that with the radar systems that were in use then, you know, you had high-powered radar, and that was really, you know, some quite powerful energy sources were plugged into radar systems, and they found that if you had something close enough to a radar transmitter, because the way that radar works, for those that are not familiar, is you have essentially a microwave energy source, like in a microwave oven, which is probably a bit more powerful, and you send that microwave energy out towards a target, such as a plane or such as something in the sky, and then that energy hits that target, and a proportion of that energy bounces off and comes back to the receiver, and therefore you can pick that up and you can register an echo, a radar echo or a radar trace, and therefore you can detect whatever it is that's in the air. So you could almost argue that a radar is a form of directed energy weapon, you know, for example. Following on from that, then, you know, when you have something too close to the radar transmitter, it can cause damage. So perhaps, I don't know if this is really how they came across this idea, but then if you realize that something that's in line of sight of a radar gets damaged, then you might think, oh, well, maybe we can use this microwave energy as some sort of weapon system to cause damage or destruction or kill people. That was, I'm guessing it was something like that where the original idea came from, and I'm really talking after the time of Tesla, because, of course, there are reports that Tesla developed a directed energy weapon, this Tesla death ray, as some have called it. And I don't have a lot of information on that. You can read the book by Mark Cipher, which is called Wizard, Tesla's The Wizard of Energy or something. I forget the exact title. But that's a good book, and that's got a bit about the Tesla death ray, which goes back to around about 1908, the early 20th century, in other words. And, you know, some people have said that this Tunguska event was actually caused by Tesla's death ray, his beam weapon. I think the jury's still out on that. But even the Mark Cipher book does talk about that and look at some of the evidence of whether that could be true or not. And when I read that, I was quite surprised, actually, that he got into that. So, you know, there is a history for using directed energy as a weapon for, you know, perhaps nearly 100 years almost, you know. Certainly for the last sort of 60, 70 years, I would say, or since the end of the Second World War. I suppose the next few things that come to mind, really, are things like the active denial system. So this is this system which is like it's taking the cover off your microwave oven, and then, you know, you turn up the energy, you crank up the energy a lot higher, and you mount the microwave oven, well, it's actually called a magnetron tube. In a microwave oven, you had a thing which is a bit like something in the back of your old cathode ray tube, you know, your old glass TV thing that you used to have in your lounge before they got replaced by flat screens and LCDs and OLEDs and all of that technology. So a magnetron tube is what is used to generate a microwave beam. And you mount that on the back of a truck, you plug in more power, you make it bigger, and then you can fire a microwave beam at people, and you can heat up the surface of their skin. Of course, if you hit them in the eye or something like that, you could cause damage to their eyesight or the eyeball. And they did press displays of this technology, I think, in 2005, 2006, and I think it was used in the Gulf War to target soldiers, to, you know, make them run away, but not a shot was fired, you know, no projectiles were fired, so they weren't actually killed by this necessarily. I'm sure you could kill people with it, and you fire these microwave beams, which is basically, you know, high frequency radio. That's when you get higher and higher frequency radio, you go up into the upper higher frequencies of the radio electromagnetic spectrum. And you can deliver energy, you know, to a small area, like the surface of somebody's skin, you know, say in a 3 or 4 centimeter square. So the energy's got to be concentrated into some sort of beam so that it can actually cause damage in the target. So that was one system, the active denial system. I think it might be the LRAD system as well. I might be getting that mixed up with something else, though. I think that's what it was, yeah, LRAD, was the active denial system. And that's like, it sort of looks like a radar dish or a square sort of radar dish on the back of a truck. You probably see the pictures. I haven't got any pictures here of that because it's not something I talk about very much. But that's a white world technology. You know, you can go, there'll be a website on US military or whoever, or if you go and look up some of the defense contractors like Raytheon or some of these other Lockheed Martin. I'm sure they've got some sort of LRAD technology somewhere. One of those manufacturers will have it on one of their websites. I can almost guarantee it. So that's a form of directed energy weapon. They have been used it for crowd control. I think even the NYPD, I think Alex Jones did a feature in his one of his films that he did put out a good few years ago, over 10 years ago, Rise of the Police State. I forget the that was a subtitle. He showed them using this LRAD system in he showed it on the back of a truck in New York City where the police were going to use it for crowd control. So it's meant to be one of these non-lethal weapons. That's something that Colonel John Alexander talks about. So yeah, microwave beams. Take the thing out of a microwave, make it bigger, put more energy in, point it at people, and that's a directed energy weapon of sorts. So you got that.
Is a laser also a directed energy weapon?
Correct. A laser can be a form of directed energy weapon when it's high enough powered. You know, you can get these laser pointers, you know, and stuff, which have quite a long range, but they don't really do any harm. You know, you're not supposed to point them in your eye, but if you were to put a laser pointer on somebody's skin, they wouldn't really feel any heat from that. It's too low energy. But then again, yeah, if you get that sort of laser, you crank up the amount of power that you put into it. Instead of putting, you know, whatever it is, a milliwatt, you put in 100 watts or 200 watts or a kilowatt, and you use maybe an infrared laser, then you can create heat in the target as well, but by a slightly different method of excitation of the molecules or the atoms in whatever you're targeting. And that's been used by the military as well. So you have some type of advanced laser system, and you make it bigger and bigger and bigger than, you know, like a gigantic laser pointer with a massive power supply onto it rather than just a AA battery or something. And you can put that in a Boeing 747, and then you can use a targeting and tracking system, and you've got the airborne laser. And that, you know, that was being developed pre-2000 by Boeing and Lockheed Martin. If you look up the ABL project, the airborne laser, I think it may have been put on ice now. I think they did develop it. They did get it working. They did a few successful tests. But again, something like that, if you start to think about the problem of the way that things like the airborne laser would work, if you're going to use a laser beam, it's all very well having it on the back of a truck and some people standing in front of you, because the truck is stationary and, relatively speaking, the people are stationary. So you can focus the beam on somebody or on a target, you know, a tank or something, and you can cause damage to it. But if you've got that in a plane, which is flying along at 300, 400 miles an hour, that's moving very quickly. And then if you've got another plane moving at 300, 400 miles an hour, how are you going to keep that laser beam focused on one spot on that plane, which is, you know, 2 miles away or whatever, or 5 miles away, and you're both moving relative to each other at 500 miles an hour? That then becomes a tracking problem, because the moment that the beam, you know, moves from the spot where it's focused, that spot is going to start to cool down. So unless you have a very, very high power beam where you can cause instant damage within a fraction of a second, you're going to need to keep that beam focused on the same spot for it to do damage. And then also you've got what's called attenuation. So if that beam is traveling through the atmosphere, through the air, some of the energy of that beam as it travels between the source and the target is going to get absorbed by the air molecules. So then you need to put in even more power, you know, to get over that problem of what's called attenuation, or loss of power as it travels through the air. And of course, higher up in the atmosphere, the air is thinner, so that's less of a problem. But you get problems like that with conventional directed energy weapons systems, and they all have that same inherent problem. You know, and then there's another one that was apparently deployed successfully. I don't think it's used much now, which was the it's called THEL, or MTHEL, which was the Mobile Tactical High Energy Laser, and that was also like a very big laser beam system. And then it was that laser beam shone through some sort of mirror or lens system on the back of a truck, and you could turn that turret, that mirror, and focus the beam on a tank or an incoming. They were using it to take out mortar bombs. Because when somebody fires a mortar bomb, you know, the only thing you can do is get out of the way. But the MTHEL, they were using it in a test, and you can, there's videos on YouTube of this from about 20 years ago. You can focus the beam on the incoming shell, and it will explode and destroy, and it doesn't reach the target, and everyone there is fine. So that's another example. You know, you can look all of those up on the internet. They're all public. You know, they're all public. They probably don't tell you the details of how they work, but it's pretty much conventional stuff. If you learn how a laser works, or you learn how a microwave magnetron tube works, you can pretty much, you know, you want to study the physics behind that. Again, I did a degree in computer science and physics, so I understand some of the physics, I understand some of the basics, but not some of the more advanced stuff about how, you know, they generate this level of power and stuff like that. And I don't really know how the tracking systems work on the airborne laser, for example, but I can make a few educated guesses, you know. So, and you know, you can get variations on all those themes. There are other forms of directed energy weapons, which might, for example, scramble your brain. So you could have a lower energy type of weapon which would beam your skull and cause effects there. So it may cause you to become disoriented. It could cause mild brain damage, and it could knock you out that way. You know, people have reported that they've been targeted with some sort of directed energy weapon. So-called targeted individuals say that this has happened to them. You know, and there was recently a chap that I interviewed on YouTube. I wasn't quite sure what to make of his story. That's what he said. He was being targeted with some sort of directed energy technology. Now, I don't know if that's true, because I didn't see if he had... I didn't see, for example, what the state of his skin was. I didn't see it before this alleged directed energy attack and after. You know, to evaluate that, you really need before and after images of somebody's skull or a brain scan before and after to see if there was some sort of anomalous damage to them. But, you know, again, the story which surfaced quite a few years ago now, probably 20 years ago, maybe longer, where there was this Russian embassy next to an American embassy or something, and the Russians had modified a microwave oven, and they were beaming, they were pointing the microwave tube through the wall or through a window or something, and targeting these people in the American embassy or you know, one of their other enemy countries' embassies with a modified microwave oven beam from a magnetron tube. You can look that story up. I can't remember the details. So I don't know if that helps any in terms of the sort of standard type of white world directed energy weapons. The really common feature of them is that they generally create some sort of heat in the target. They heat up the target, and it's the heat that's generated in the target, of course, that causes the damage, you know, or maybe the disturbance to cells in the brain, for example, which might be heat, or it might be some disturbance in electrical activity, for example, that causes the damage.
Andrew, in terms of cost benefit of these types of weapons, is it something that is beneficial?
Well, I mean, you need to ask a military analyst that sort of question, Jeremy. And I don't work for the military. I don't know anybody that works for the military. Mm. All I would say is that you don't have to worry about projectiles. You don't have to worry about, you know, putting projectiles in these weapons and, you know, the expense of creating projectiles, because you're just literally firing energy at the target. So whether that makes them cheaper, it probably makes them cheaper to run, but because of their technical sophistication and also the technical problems, you know, that you encounter in, for example, making a very high energy laser, which is doesn't need to be in a building, something that can be used in the field. Those are quite difficult problems to solve in white world technologies, in what's been disclosed to the white world. So as regards cost benefit, then maybe they're cheaper to run, but that will depend on how reliable they are and whether they can be used in combat. So I think my understanding is that the directed energy weapons, they probably have used them in combat, and I think they've disclosed some of that use from time to time. But I suspect that, as with what happened on 9/11, there are black world directed energy weapon systems which we can only make guesses about, and they, to my understanding, operate on a different physics, essentially, to one that is taught in the white world, basically, in the physics that I studied. These directed energy weapons don't really operate on those sorts of principles. They operate on different principles. And can you still hear me okay? And can you still hear you okay?
Perfect.
Is that all right?
You're perfect. In actual fact, the connection is actually better than earlier.
Weird. Yeah, it might be just because I've got, I don't know, maybe this is better on this laptop. This has got a slightly more powerful processor, perhaps. Anyway, as long as it works, that's the main thing.
Yeah, I'll chop all this out later and I'll make it look good again. I just want to make sure, are you still able to screen share?
I am. So what I'm going to do is I'm just going to have another little fiddle here with my computer. Right.
Right, you can hear me now.
Oh, yeah, it was my fault. So, yeah, I've plugged into the external screen. So, because what it does, when you plug in, as you're probably aware, when you switch to an external monitor, if that monitor has got speakers in it, which this one has, it switches the audio to that. This one thinks it's got speakers, but it hasn't, so there was nothing coming out of the monitor, so I couldn't hear you, because I just plugged this instrument. Right, here we go. Right.
You're welcome to, if you want to, you're welcome to jump straight into the slideshow. I've got it on my screen. 9/11, finding the truth.
Yeah, so let's see if we can find an entry point to this, though, because I'm just going to escape there and just go back to a particular slide, because we probably want to start talking a bit more about other sorts of directed energy weapons. Maybe I'll show a couple of other slides.
I don't mind. It's up to you, Andrew. You can take me in any direction you want. It's all related anyway.
All right. So... So perhaps start with these two slides then. So I'll do a bit of transitioning from the directed energy weapons into 9/11, and sort of get that going. So I'll do that and then I'll come to this slide. So you might want to leave my face up, possibly. I don't know while I'm talking. And then I'll talk about the next slide and you can bring that in. I can cue that up there. Let's just press that. Right. And then we can...
I've got your face at the bottom.
Okay. All right, so you can carry on now. Then you're still recording, right? Or yeah, okay. So, so we talked about what I call white world directed energy weapon systems. Some of them, they all basically work by generating heat in the target, and then you get destruction on that basis. You have to point the beam at the target, typically, in most cases. And that's what creates the damage. So you may recall in your conversation with Dr. Judy Wood and maybe other people that talked about 9/11, and maybe some of them mentioned Dr. Judy Wood. I know that one of your other guests, Jim Fetzer, I saw him listed on your website. He's talked about Dr. Judy Wood a lot. I've had a lot of experiences with him back in between 2007 2010. I've written a lot about Jim Fetzer. And basically, I think Fetzer knows what really happened on 9/11, and I think he's deliberately putting out false information about mini nukes and all of that stuff. And I've written my reasons for saying that quite extensively, so I won't go into that here. But what we were talking about is directed energy weapons, and when Fetzer interviewed Dr. Judy Wood in November 2006, she actually said something in that interview. It was November the 11th, believe it or not, 2006. I've got that interview on my website, checktheevidence.com. Go to the audio folder on 9/11, find that. And in that interview, Dr. Judy Wood was pointing out that there were circular holes about 24 feet in diameter in some of the buildings, like, I think, might not have got this exactly right, but World Trade Center 5, and there were some in other buildings as well, maybe a bit of one in World Trade Center 4 or part of one, and then there were these 24-foot circular holes in the street as well. And she was highlighting a number of these, and she had the images of these. I think they're still on her website, on the old version, if you look for the holes version, holes page rather, in the old version of the website, go to drjudywood.com. And so this is where she started to wonder about whether there was some sort of beam weapon which had been developed in the Star Wars program. And this name was given to her by another chap, Frank Ferguson, because, of course, when we say Star Wars program, that was the popular name for it. This was Reagan's Strategic Defense Initiative, which the press and the public started to call Star Wars because of the, you know, Star Wars was quite popular in the early 80s with the, you know, the original Star Wars film, The Empire Strikes Back and Return of the Jedi. They'd been doing the rounds, and of course that was about wars and stars, so they called SDI Star Wars, Reagan's Star Wars program, of course. Why not? And so that then got construed by people. Jim Fetz has got to stir in the pot a little bit on that one. And Dr. Judy Wood said, well, look, I think this weapon system might possibly be orbital. That's all she said. It might be orbital. And so that then got misconstrued as being a beam weapon, a directed energy beam weapon, in other words. We talked about the beam weapon. And she was aware of the SDI program. I don't think at that point she'd studied all the sort of ins and outs of what I discussed a few minutes ago with the airborne laser and the mobile tactical high-energy laser. You know, and we can be pretty certain that the military have got advanced technology. They're not going to tell people how it works. They're not going to have press conferences about it because they're going to, you know, remove their strategic advantage with that technology. So they're going to keep mum about it, aren't they? You know, that's pretty obvious. So Dr. Judy realised fairly early on that she'd stumbled on some sort of energy weapon system that was in use. She didn't know what it was, but she surmised that it might be something to do with this SDI program, the Star Wars program. So that got all melded together, and then she said, oh, Dr. Judy Wood talks about space beams. That was Stephen E. Jones who essentially came up with that term. And that then... So that everyone said, oh, Judy Wood's, you know, bringing the truth movement into disrepute by talking about this silly nonsense about Star Wars and all of that. What a load of tosh that is. And it kind of went from there, really. But she never said that. She said what I said she said, which is that she talked about some sort of directed energy being used to destroy the World Trade Center. And, you know, and it might have been developed in the SDI program, the Star Wars program. But she didn't know what it was at that point, and she was doing further research at the time to establish from the evidence what else we could find out about the energy. And she was convinced that some sort of energy had been used to destroy the towers. Therefore, the energy had been directed to destroy the towers. The energy had been instructed to do something, as she says. So she, I think, fairly quickly realised, after having done that interview with Fetzer, that it wasn't just as simple as a beam, you know, coming down from a satellite or something like that and going into the towers and blowing them apart. It wasn't that simple. It wasn't like that. And, you know, you had people like Greg Jenkins say, oh, that's ridiculous. You need about, you know, 15 terawatts of energy to do that. And she never even attempted to calculate the amount of energy, and she didn't feel that she needed to do that. And she didn't, because you could see the energy effects in other ways, like, for, I must try and show some pictures. I mean, she may have already seen some of these, but she, Dr. Judy Wood, has talked about the levitated cars. She's talked about the toasted cars. I'll get that picture up that I showed you before we started recording. But I just want to then sort of transition into how I kind of got involved in 9/11 research and stuff, or came into contact with Dr. Judy Wood, because I was of the view, and you might want to show this slide here, that I've got, if you bring that up. And I was of the view that bombs had been used to destroy the World Trade Center towers. Bombs in the building, that we came to call that scenario. And I was pretty convinced by that between about 2005 and 2007, really, pretty much 2 years, best part of. And then I began to realize that that didn't explain all the evidence. So this slide here shows on the left that the World Trade Center was destroyed by fire, according to the mainstream media, or the shame stream media, as I now call it, following the COVID scam that they foisted on us all.
Jet fuel. That's the official argument.
Jet fuel, indeed. And again, you look at the figures for that, it doesn't stack up. The physics doesn't stack up. Steel melts at whatever it is, 1,200 degrees, 1,500 degrees centigrade. Jet fuel burns at 600. So you can just use that argument right there to prove it doesn't work. And the jet fuel theory doesn't work. And not only that, but the towers didn't burn up. They didn't slam to the ground. They turned to dust in midair. And even the advanced directed energy weapons that we've talked about in the white world, in MTHEL, the ABL and similar examples, LRAD, none of those turn things to dust. They can create heat and fire in or near the target or wherever they're directed, basically, and cause melting, but they don't turn things to dust. And that was one of the big things. If you look at the picture on the right on this slide, the towers turn to dust. Mostly to dust, but about 90% before they hit the ground. So that right there, that observation, and it is an observation, it's a fact, it's not a theory. There isn't a theory that the towers turned to dust. They did turn to dust. About 90% of them, 85-90%. That rules out bombs, it rules out nukes, it rules out conventional directed energy weapons, and it rules out jet fuel as being the destructive mechanism or the primary destructive mechanism. But yet, still, we have groups and people promoting these theories when we know, and we've known for, well, Dr. Judy Wood has known since pretty much day one, really, that they don't explain the evidence. You know, and those of us that have studied this have known that they don't explain the evidence. Bombs in the building, nukes, whatever, thermite, they don't explain the evidence that Dr. Judy Wood collected, and it's primarily her that's collected that evidence. So, that picture right there shows you the three positions and essentially the three layers of cover-up that are involved in 9/11. You know, you've got to take that into account. Okay, so we'll move on a couple of slides. Let's see if I'm just going to move on to the next slide here and. Yeah, so this is a slide I've created about seeing an illusion, and this works with multiple levels, really. You may have seen this before, but basically if you think of this picture as, well, you think it's just like a calm scene with a lake. Mm. You're not maybe quite sure whether you're looking at a painting or a photograph or some CGI or something. Well, it doesn't really matter for the purposes of this, but what you'll see is, if I go on to the next slide, there is a pattern embedded in this picture. And you will actually see, if you go back now, that there is the image of a fetal-like baby drawn into the shape of the tree line. And the.
Oh, yes.
And so, in other words, this picture, there's many pictures like this that you can use this sort of example. In other words, in this picture, there is more data than there first appears. There is the image of a child, of a baby. You didn't see that at first, but when you studied it more closely or things were pointed out to you, you see there is more going on. There's something else going on there. And that's essentially what happened with Dr. Judy Wood's research. She, you know, showed in all of these pictures that she showed, other things were going on, right? So it wasn't bombs in the building, it wasn't conventional directed energy weapons, it wasn't jet fuel, it wasn't fire. There was something else going on. And it's quite easy to see that once you've seen basic things. So, you know, again, once you've seen that image, you can't go back. Next time you see that image, it might be 3 years, 4 years time or something, you will see, oh yeah, I remember that. There's a baby in there if you look for it. So let's just... I'll skip that and go back to my thingy now and go to another slide, I think. So I realised from speaking to Dr. Judy Wood that she had collected some very important evidence. And then she goes, for example, to talk to expand on what we said about turning to dust. She showed these two pictures side by side. Let me just put those up. And she asked a simple question. Do these pictures showing a build, show a building which is collapsing? because if you use bombs in the building, the bombs cut the building into chunks and the chunks fall to the ground, so you get a pile of chunks on the ground. Same with nukes, really, although the chunks might be smaller. But nuclear explosions tend to melt things and, in some cases, vaporize them. But that's not what happened. Nukes are very, very hot when they explode. You know, some people debate whether they even can explode. But, you know, I think they can explode under the right circumstances. And we know for a fact as well that people were walking out of the destruction. If you look at the picture on the right here, somewhere in that mass of dust, there is, I think, stairwell B, which was about, I think, 7 or 8 stories off the ground, 6 or 7 stories off the ground. 14 people survived, and when they looked up, they saw a blue sky. That's not possible with a nuclear device of, you know, the size needed to destroy these buildings. They would have been fried to a crisp. They would have been irradiated. The whole site would have been irradiated. You know, and if people say there's some other form of nuclear explosion, then tell me what it is, because I've never heard of it.
Yeah.
You know, what is that? You know, you've got uranium-238, or is it 235? 235 that's the radioactive isotope. That's what is used to generate nuclear explosion. If you want to generate a hotter explosion, then you can go into a fusion reaction, which is the hydrogen bomb, where you set off an atomic bomb, and then around that you have hydrogen. That starts a fusion reaction in the hydrogen gas, which creates an even hotter explosion. That would create an enormous amount of heat and light. Can you see any heat or light on that? But can you see light on that picture of like, no, you can't, because there isn't any real, no, there's been a few little tiny flashes of light bulbs exploding or something like that. But there is no bright light. There was no loud sound. We've got a video of, I don't know if I've got it in this presentation, of World Trade Center 7 being destroyed, and there's a lady called Barbara Crowley being interviewed while the tower is being destroyed about 4 blocks away. That's not a nuclear explosion. That is being turned to dust, or has been turned to dust, and then the final stage is to let the building go. And then Dr. G. Wood showed this picture. Let's see if we can get this video to play. I think this should play. This is, you can see these towers turning to dust before your very eyes. Let's see if that plays. Might be a little bit jerky over this link, like the way we're doing it, but there we go. You can go and look these videos up online and get clearer versions, no problem. This will not look very good on this arrangement, I don't think. You'll just about be able to see the spire, the so-called spire, which is 70 stories of steel columns just towards the end of this clip, turning to dust before your very eyes.
So that's pretty famous, that column.
Yeah. So, you know, I'd never seen this until I'd never noticed this, put it where. I may have seen him, but I wouldn't point it out to me how strange this was. But that's looking very choppy on here, so I don't think we'll get much out of that in this thing, because I've got another little animation here created by Dr. Judy Wood. This should come out a bit better, showing a sequence of still images that somebody with a camera took as those 70 stories of the spire turned to dust, and there it is again. And in the foreground you can see World Trade Center 7 there behind that sort of water tower thing, and that turned to dust as well. Wasn't the controlled demolition. I've got a page about that. So we're back to really to directed energy weapons again, and these directed energy weapons work on a very different principle. They don't use necessarily, or at least they don't use a directed energy beam alone. They must use something else as well. So, you know, we've got to consider that. Let's just come out of that now. And as Dr. Wood has pointed out many times, I've shown this image many times, if there was a nuclear explosion or bombs in the building, then you wouldn't have seen this sort of effect in the aftermath, where a bit basically, you know, you can see in the book that if you look at what's left, Dr. Wood highlighted that that's an 8-story building between the two horizontal purple lines on the left. And that is pretty much the height of the debris pile, which is near in the foreground. It's maybe like 2 stories to the top of that, and you see it's not even full. And she gave an indication of the amount of material that is basically missing. It's gone missing. So again, if you had a nuclear device, how would it destroy all that material whilst still having the buildings around it completely intact? You know, it just wouldn't work. It doesn't work because the nuke or bombs in the building story is wrong. It wasn't that. And the fact that so many versions of this have been put out over the years, as I said, saying earlier, Jeremy, we had Ed Ward started it. Then it was put out by Jeff Prager. I've written all of this up in my two 9/11 books, 9/11 Finding the Truth and 9/11 Holding the Truth. Then it was put out by Heinz Pomner. Then it was put out by, sorry, I've got it the order wrong. It was Ed Ward, Dmitry Karlazov, Jeff Prager, and then Heinz Pomner. They've all done versions of this nuke idea with, you know, neutron bombs or, you know, hot nukes, cold nukes, mini nukes, whatever it is, nukes. And it's like they're so desperate for it, they've got to come up with some nuke thing, because Dr. Judy Wood cannot be right, can she? You know, we can't have her being right about what she says. But the point that Dr. Judy Wood is right on about, and the element of the nuclear theory, which is true, is a nuclear process was involved in the destruction. And by that we mean that something happened to the nucleus in the atoms of the material which made up the World Trade Center towers and the people and other things. There was some nuclear effect going on, but it wasn't like a nuclear explosion. Somebody, essentially, as to our way of looking at it, knows how to tell atoms and molecules to fall apart, to change their state. They know how to make atoms of an element change into atoms of another element, right? That's where the nuclear thing comes in. And if you are interested in getting people into a tizzy, getting them muddled up, then you can talk about nuclear bombs. But what you're really talking about, if you want to tell the truth about this, is a nuclear process, some process which is affecting the nucleus of the atoms and molecule in some way. And with careful study of the evidence, you can actually find out a little bit more about that. And so, you know, we can maybe talk about that. But, you know, this is the only way to explain what happened to the towers, what happened to their physical material. They underwent some type of breakdown, not just a destruction, but a breakdown, dustification, as Dr. Judy Wood has said. But even the dust itself, you could argue, was dustified because it kept on breaking down. It became finer and finer and finer. And it's like somebody flicked a switch and said, right, I want all this material in the World Trade Center towers to fall apart, please, and just, you know, disintegrate. I'm going to flick a switch. That's almost what they did, you know, and the destruction and the disintegration process wasn't instant. It happened over a number of hours. For World Trade Center 1 and 2, it appeared to take between 1 and 2 hours. And for World Trade Center number 7, it seemed to take quite a bit longer, like 5, 6, 7 hours. So, you know, that's where we start to get into what actually went on. So let's just go. Yeah, and I mean, look what's left of the site. And as Dr. Wood pointed out, this is in her book, how come the only buildings that were severely damaged and had to be removed or were removed on the day are the ones with the WTC prefix? How could you target a nuclear bomb or other bombs like that? And guarantee that the other, like the Millennium Hotel, was untouched. And we know that the Bankers Trust building was damaged, and that was later taken down over a period of years. When I went to New York in 2008, that Bankers Trust, I think they still had about 10 stories of that left. They were taking it down piece by piece. And that's a whole story in itself. There is no other explanation, really. The other explanations just don't work. They don't explain this. So the people that put these explanations forward just ignore it. They just ignore the fact that all the other buildings were pretty much intact.
What of Building 5, which very obviously looked like it just fell into its own footprint?
Well, I mean, there is still a bit of Building 5 left, as you can see there. I'd have to study the book. I can't remember the exact details for Building 5. But you can see it's got this. You can sort of see on that picture a bit. I might have another picture in this presentation, but it's not the focus of it. There are these cutouts in the building. So this is where this idea of some sort of beam coming down from above potentially that's where that kind of started, you know. So building number five, I'm not sure they will have pulled that down. It wasn't destroyed outright on the day, but you can see it's, you know, a lesser amount of damage than the other buildings. World Trade Center building number four, I think I've got a slide of that later on, I can't remember, but that was cut in half. That's really extraordinary. It looks like, as Dr. Wood said, it looks like it was sliced in two with an X-Acto knife, or a Stanley knife, as we call it in the UK. I'll see if I've got that picture. Let's see if I have. Yeah, I haven't really got. But what I would want, now we're talking, I think if I show you this picture, this is relevant to the energy question quite a bit, yeah. I think, because somebody, this, I don't think this is in the Where Did the Towers Go book. Somebody sent me this. It may have come from Judy's collection originally. I think when I showed this to her, she was aware of it, but I'm not sure if she got it on her website. It doesn't really matter, but it is from 9/11. We can see in the top picture, we actually have building World Trade Center Building 7 behind this sort of very badly damaged bus. You can see World Trade Center 7 at the back. There's a little green sign there. And if you look at where the bus is in relation to this tree, you can see it's in a certain position. And then if we look at World Trade Center Building 7 after it's been destroyed, we can see that this bus or whatever it is in even worse condition, and it appears to have moved as well. And I don't think that's just where this, it appears to have moved up the street, but you can see that there's considerably more damage to the front of it, and the wheels have gone out even more, and there's more damage to it. The grid structure of the windows, what would have held the windows, has been completely destroyed. But it's not covered in any more debris. And the tree still seems to be in more or less the same state, I think. It's a bit difficult to tell if it's the same tree or another tree. But that has moved. And this is another thing we've seen evidence of, things that were turned upside down, selectively, it would appear. And then there were selective effects on materials, like as Dr. Wood highlighted. I'll see if I've got a picture of that. So this is we're starting to look at some of the evidence of energy here. So that we go, we need to go a bit later because that just goes into various other things there. So I'm going to get that up a bit from there, I think. Yeah, so we can look at some of the other effects. Yeah, so just we'll just look at a couple of these pictures as well. So similarly, you can see here these clouds of dust coming out. This is before the destruction of World Trade Center 7, which is shown here on the bottom right. And you can see these beams do actually turn to dust before they hit the ground. We've got, you can watch the Irrefutable film, Adam Dwyer's film, and you'll see all of that in quite high resolution. And then you can see this carpet of dust on the road. Yet, as you can see, as everyone talks about this element, nearly everyone, which is the paper that survived. There was paper blowing everywhere. How did this paper survive a nuclear blast or a hot fire caused by bombs or a hot fire caused by some type of nuclear bomb going off? It's not possible. It didn't happen. So this was something else, something which affected the metal, but not the paper. It had selective effects on materials. We've seen that picture before. So people said that the debris was all shipped to China. Well, if we look at this picture again, I know I showed it a few minutes ago, but again, where is the debris? This was taken before the destruction of World Trade Center number 7, which again is here on the background, so in the towards the left of the picture. That's World Trade Center 7. That was destroyed at 5:20 in the evening. So we know that this picture was taken before then, and looking at the angle of the sun, probably taken about 2 o'clock, 1 o'clock in the afternoon. But there's no buildings left. All the debris is gone, or not all of it, a very large proportion of it. So that means that something made the buildings disappear, and it wasn't a nuclear explosion that did that. So that's another revisit of that picture, showing that the debris was gone, most of it was gone, by 1 o'clock in the afternoon. It wasn't shipped to China. There was no debris essentially to ship to China. I think all of it was just about all of it was shipped to Freshkills, a few miles outside Manhattan. And again, if the towers were cut up into chunks and those chunks fell to the ground with the force of gravity, then how come this ambulance survived? The roof is still there. You should have like 100 stories of building on top of that, crushing it completely crushed in, that it's not even buried. So where did those, how is it that it's, that missed being under floors and floors and floors of debris? How can that have happened? And then again, people say, well, all the debris went into the basements because there were 9 stories of shops and shopping mall and everything underneath the World Trade Center. So surely, if the debris wasn't found on the surface, it must have crashed through into the basements, right? Must have done. Well, no, actually, it didn't, because here you can see people walking around in water at the bottom. I don't know how many floors under, but this is below the World Trade Center. And on the next slide, you can actually see some of these. I don't think it's on this picture, but there is another picture where you can see the shop signs here on the left. And so we know that this is a shopping mall. And they're looking for survivors, looking for... So that was under the World Trade Center, so the debris didn't end up there either. So where did it go? Looking at for the energy effects, again, another one that Dr. Judy identified was a number of cases of this, where, for example, we've got this inflated tire on the back of this police car. We've got a fairly good paint job here. But yet only a few inches away, we've got apparently what looks like very high heat. And that's been heat has been high enough to warp the metal and cause all that damage. I mean, is this a real car fire? Doesn't look like it to me.
Mm-mm.
And then we've got on the picture on the left, we've got upholstery there. Isn't that the first thing to get destroyed in a car fire? Well, not here, folks. The upholstery is intact. So what's that about? So this is where we get selective effects on materials, with metal being damaged more, say, than upholstery. Doesn't make any sense. So this is why it's an energy effect. And this is another similar situation here, where the handle is pretty much intact on this car door, just to the top right of this insert, yet the tyre is inflated. And in fact, we've got a similar pattern of damage, where the middle of the car is badly damaged, whereas the rear is not as badly damaged. The trunk is open as well, and it appears that the whatever holds the trunk shut, which is a different metal, has been affected by some form of energy and has melted or become jellified or structurally unsound, and the trunk's popped open. Yet the trunk itself looks to be in fairly good shape just on a quick visual examination. And you had these polycarbonate lights on the top, that some of those were still intact, whereas the metal appeared to have been very severely burned. Doesn't make any sense. Now, you know, people said, oh, well, the reason for this is what happened is there was a large explosion. The hot material from the towers fell onto these cars and caused some of the damage, but it wasn't enough to set the whole car alight. And these cars were then towed a quarter of a mile to FDR Drive, and that's why you see the damage here, not outside the World Trade Center. Well, do you think that's really going to happen? Are they really going to have time to tow a few police cars to FDR Drive, you know, so that the damage is seen there and not outside the World Trade Center, which was where it actually happened? Do you think that? Well, it's possible, isn't it? It's possible that they were towed.
Mm.
But let's move on to another picture that Dr. Judy Wood found, or a pair of pictures. So she found this pair of pictures. Somebody who's about a quarter or a half mile from the World Trade Center, there was a parking lot, or a car park, as we say here, near the World Trade Center. And this person was looking at, you know, presumably taking pictures of all these people milling about. And we got all the cars parked here. And then I think it's probably an hour or two later, I think one was before the destruction of Tower 1 and the other was after the destruction of Tower 1. And this was the picture that was taken after Tower 1. So you can see the sun has moved round. So this is probably 2 or 3 hours after the previous one. but you can see that the cars have become damaged, yet they are still in the parking lot. So I created an animation from these two images, and you should be able to see, if you look carefully, and I've made a video about this on my YouTube channel and zoomed in even more into this, that some of these cars are okay before and after the destruction of the towers, and some of them are not. We have a black SUV-type car and a red one, and they're both okay before and after, but the two cars next to them, they're damaged. They're rusting. They're actually rusting. And you see this with several other cars in that picture. So this proves, all right, several things. It proves that there is some sort of energy effect going on, because you can't have selective fire doing that. And even if it was fire, you wouldn't have fire creating rust that quickly, right? It proves that. It proves that these cars didn't move, right? So they weren't towed. These cars were not towed. They've been toasted in place, right? So that proves that there are liars around on the internet claiming that these toasted cars were moved. Why would they want to do that? Why would somebody want to say, oh, well, those toasted cars were moved? And you show them this picture and you can say, look, these cars were not moved. Why didn't you accept that they weren't moved and apologize for accusing somebody of putting out false information when it's you that's putting out false information? Why would you want to persist with that lie when we have pictures like this? And it's not just this, there's other evidence as well. There's witness accounts saying that people were walking down the streets and these cars were bursting into flames as they were walking past. Patricia Ondrovich, I think, is one of those witnesses, if you want a name. I think that accounts in Dr. Judy Wood's book. So this is why I like to show this particular pair of pictures, because I think it's extremely important. This proves that, A, there are liars in the truth movement wanting to cover up this important evidence because of how important it is. Similarly, looking at energy effects from this other undisclosed type of weapon, not a hot, this doesn't create heat. It looks like it creates heat, but it creates the same sort of physical change as heat does, but not using high temperatures. That's the way that I would describe this or characterize this. So you can see that this engine block has completely gone from the truck, and this tire here on the truck, if you look at that closely, it's like partly melted. There's some change in it somehow. And again, we've got this weird toasting effect. Some of it is okay, some of it is completely melted away. And then we've got this truck here, partly damaged. In fact, it's more damaged on the inside than the outside. That's slightly odd. And same here, this has more damage on the inside than on the outside. So what's that about? This picture, Dr. Judy Wood pointed out, was taken, I think, on the 13th or the 14th of September. Back of the truck's fine, but the front is really badly rusted. It looks like it's been, you know, in a damp climate for years, yet this is only 2 or 3 days after 9/11. So how does that change happen? And this is where we get into the idea that something is causing this metal to rust rapidly. It's causing changes in the atoms of the metal somehow. This is called transmutation, right? And there's a very interesting channel called Martin Fleischmann Memorial Project, which is run by a chap I know, a friend of mine, Bob Greenier, and he's investigated a lot of these effects more thoroughly, occurring in certain other experiments which you don't normally come across. Looking at how this might tie into other things, such as the way that gravity works, because that's what this is to do with ultimately. How does gravity work? Well, it's meant to be a mystery, but I think somebody knows exactly how gravity works, because one of the side effects of this directed energy weapon system, whatever you want to call it, is that it affects gravity. Here we have three instances of cars that have been turned upside down. And in the background of this picture, we have a fire truck that's upside down. How did this happen? Nuclear bombs don't do that, not in this way. They don't selectively turn things upside down and leave other things undamaged. So this again is effective energy of some kind. And this energy is affecting the force of gravity. Another interesting phenomenon that Dr. Judy noticed and documented is where you've got these double glazed window units but there's several here. This one, for example, where we have panes which have both panes are broken, and but in others only one pane is broken. There are several examples of this that she found. How is this possible? And it appears that what's happened is that this isn't a projectile that has gone through these panes, but it's some sort of energy, some type of energy resonance effect, which has essentially shaken the pane and caused only one of the panes to break. And all this marble has gone from the front of, I think this is the World Financial Center here. This was all marble that's come off. So why is that all just completely gone? It seems to have disappeared completely. That's another selective effect on materials. And here's another example of what I just said, where we've got only one pane is broken, whereas the others there are all broken, both are broken, in, and the damage looks quite strange. It's not been caused by projectiles. Mm. The other thing that was very suspicious after 9/11, this is another thing where we think that this, well, it seems pretty clear that this energy that was used to destroy the towers didn't immediately dissipate. It didn't die down, because it appears that somebody was trying to dampen down the effects of this energy by actually taking landfill onto the site and putting on top of the debris. You've got actually soil here in some of these pictures. I think on this next one, you can see there's rubbish and soil has been put on top of the debris. And we argue that... you know, Dr. Judy Wood has argued, I've argued, that this is actually trying to soak up whatever residual energy is left in the material and in the ground following the destruction of the World Trade Center. This is an energy that hangs around, and that's why they needed to put out these stories of the fires burning for 99 days, because the energy that's residually there in the material can cause fuming, which looks like smoke. But it's not smoke, it's continual breakdown of the material, or that's probably what it is. And this is ongoing for like months, actually. There's a very interesting video by John Snow of Channel 4 in the UK showing this fuming when he went there, I think, in about a month after the destruction. And there's all this fuming coming out of the ground when he's walking around. But it's not fire. But this is the story that Giuliani put out. It said that fires burned for 99 days after the destruction. No, they didn't, Giuliani. They didn't at all. You're putting out a cover story, man. Even if you don't know that you are. Even if that's what you've been told to say. I think he probably had some knowledge, but he could have just been putting out a story. And again, more of this landfill in these images on top of the fire truck, for heaven's sake. So it looks like they were trying to dampen down whatever it was that had happened to you know, the energy system that was still there. And it was on WTC7's pile as well. They put some on there somehow. I don't think that's just building debris. They put stuff on top of it. Okay, so there really, you know, you've seen some of the evidence, and there's a lot more in Dr. Judy Wood's book. There's more on the website, drjudywood.com, where we're arguing that, yes, it's directed energy, but it's not the directed energy of the sort that we described earlier in the talk. It's not lasers. It's not laser beams from space. It's not microwave beams from space necessarily, although... To go into that, Dr. Judy Wood has noted that it appears that people in the World Trade Center experienced the effects of microwave beams. She thinks that that's what happened to them when they were making phone calls and describing how they were heated up in some way. But the way that they were heated up didn't really tally with them being next to a hot fire. That didn't seem to be what was happening to them.
Andrew, do you by any chance... have an idea, even if it's just speculation, as to where the source or sources of these energy weapons would have been?
Not exactly. There is one source which we can be fairly confident that was used, and we know where it was. I'll try and put up some slides of that shortly. The Dr. Judy Wood talked about people being microwaved in the towers. Where did that come from? Don't really know. It could have well come from some sort of aerial platform. We don't really know. It could have come from one of the surrounding buildings. Don't really know which one, so don't ask me. We haven't talked about what this technology is, which is to do with something called the Hutchinson effect. And when we talked about this in November 2007, when Dr. Wood and I discussed this, it was really that was the trigger point at which Jim Fetzer really turned against us when we started talking about this energy configuration, or call it what you will, being similar or even the same as what John Hutchinson was using. And Fetzer really...
Which was what?
Well, John Hutchinson uses... I think I've got some slides of him. Let me just see if I can find those slides so I can sort of illustrate what I'm talking about, so it makes a bit more sense. Well, but before we go to that, let's just go back to directed energy weapons in the conventional sense. And people actually said, when Dr. Wood talked about directed energy weapons, she said that they... people said they don't exist. Well, we said, well, they do. They do exist. You have this, for example. This is one of the things we pointed out. You've got the Directed Energy Professional Society. And the actual founding members of this are companies that were involved. Two of them are founding members of Directed Energy Professional Society. Two of those companies were involved in the investigation of the destruction of the World Trade Center for NIST. That was Science Applications International Corporation and Applied Research Associates. So they are directed energy researchers and developers, R&D. They were involved in writing the technical reports called The Collapse of the World Trade Center Towers, which NIST produced in 2005. Also, Norma Mineta, who was a transport secretary during the Clinton administration, and he was held over to the Bush administration, he actually works for Lockheed Martin. So, which they also produced directed energy weapons. That was another little... I think he was doing a bit of misdirection as well at the time when he was talking about this Cheney being... knowing that they were going to crash this plane into the Pentagon. He did a bit of misdirection on that. Airborne laser we've talked about. That's a slide on that. But the other thing, before we get into the Hutchinson effect and stuff and trying to answer that question of where the energy weapon was or the source was, let's just mention this. You know, we did try and get some answers out of people when Dr. Wood was researching this. And Jerry Leapheart, who was the attorney that put together Dr. Wood's court case back in 2006, 2007 timeframe up to 2009, he actually ended up writing. We found out, or he found out, or Dr. Wood found out, that there was a directed energy directorate at Kirtland Air Force Base. So this was a part of the Air Force which is involved in developing and studying directed energy weapon systems. So that's a real thing. You can go and look them up. I think they have a website and stuff. And we wrote to them, and Rich Garcia replied, and he said, you report phenomena that we cannot explain here, either because we don't have enough data or because the phenomena are not within our area of expertise. So Rich Garcia didn't say that Al-Qaeda destroyed the World Trade Center. He admitted that what Dr. Wood had presented to them was inexplicable. You know, so he actually did better than the truthers. And this is a guy who works for the military. He did better than the truthers were doing. He admitted that they couldn't explain it. They didn't have the expertise. That's probably true, because Rich Garcia is a white world guy. This is not white world technology. It's black world technology. Okay, let's just see if I can go back to my list and go down a bit. Yes. So let's talk about John Hutchinson. So this was, you know, a lot of what I've shown you and more was put into a court case, as I've said, and you can find out about that on drjudywatt.com. So we'll now try and consider what, you know, the questions that you asked, where was this energy source? What was it? Can you tell us any more? Well, maybe a bit. So John Hutchinson, he's on Facebook. He posts stuff pretty much daily. You can talk to him on Facebook. He's a lovely guy. He likes to dress up as a woman, though, so I would warn you about that. But he's a lovely guy. And he's been doing this stuff since 1979. You see here a sample of metal. There's loads of videos of him on YouTube, Odyssey. His videos go back to the early 80s. I've got a DVD of his videos from news reports in the 80s, which I was shipping that out for years. I haven't stopped doing DVDs, but there's one that There's a presentation that Dr. Wood and John Hutchison did in Seattle in 2008 where they go into a lot of more detail about what I'm showing you on this slide. And I would say to anyone that wants these links or videos, if you can't find them, write to me through checktheevidence.com. Tell me what you want to see and I'll try and find it for you if you can't find it yourself. So that's, you know, it is there. John has produced samples and done experiments which show jellification of metal. They show bending and fracturing of material. They show lift and disintegration. They show transmutation, which is one metal changing into another. They show fuming, which is not necessarily the production of smoke. They show disappearance of samples, just disappearing into thin air, and the fusing of dissimilar materials without heat or with very little heat, such as metal and wood. That's what he's been doing. I've got a video clip here. I won't be able to play this, really. Where he shows you some of these samples of material and stuff. But for example, this clip might play. We'll see how well this plays, if it is going to play. He did this experiment in November 2006. I got the date wrong on that video. I've never gone back and corrected it. And he has this model boat. I think it's about a meter long, something like that, in a tank of water. What he's doing here is he's got like some X radar equipment and he's firing a microwave beam into the area where this boat is. He's then got some sort of magnetic field being generated, and then he's got what's called an electrostatic field being generated by, say, a Tesla coil or a Van de Graaff generator or something like that. And he switches the microwave beam on and off. He pulses it. He sets certain frequencies of microwaves. He sets a certain sets the magnetic field to pulse in certain ways. I'm not sure exactly what he does, but it's to do with varying the magnetic field, the electrostatic field, the microwave energy frequency, the pulsing, and the amount of energy. And by varying that in certain ways that only he knows how, you can produce these effects, levitation, bending of materials, and in this case, you can produce these anomalous fires. If you notice now, the water has gone, the water goes calm, that's when things are switched off, and you can see a fire breaks out on the boat and goes round the edge of the boat. And this is very similar to the fires that were seen at the World Trade Center, where we've got car fires raging with paper right next to them, not burning. So we've got one effect there, weird fires. John has created those, and those were seen on 9/11. John has bent into a bow, like that, on the left. That's a 3-inch diameter copper beam. He again subjected that to microwave, magnetic fields, electrostatic fields in a certain combinations, and that's what happened to it. Look what happened to the beam at the World Trade Center, held it by WJE in their warehouse. Similarly, John, this is a photograph that Dr. Wood took when she went to see John in 2008. It was the 18th of February 2008 when she went to see him. And you can see that this metal is laminated, it's delaminated, it's like gone into layers. Somehow these crystalline layers have formed somehow. That was done with one of John's experiments. And that has some similarities to some of what happened to the steel beams at the World Trade Center. And John has created levitation. He's done a Red Ball can experiment where this flies up out of the experimental area. He's also got a 70-pound cannonball that he's levitated. That video is available online as well, and I've got that on one of my DVDs. Various videos of that. People have claimed that, you know, he always got a magnet underneath it. You know, he's using an upside down rig. And then what he's doing is pulling the magnet away, and then the can falls down, but actually it looks like it's flying up because he's filmed it upside down. No, that's what Ace Baker claimed. John's not doing that. You can see, actually, that this can actually deforms slightly as well, and then it flies up. So, and there it goes again. So, John can do levitation, which is what was seen at the World Trade Center. I showed this picture earlier of the ESU truck, and this was a Red Bull can that John subjected to his energy beams, and then it later disintegrated or partly disintegrated. It looks very similar to me.
Sure.
And we have witness accounts of levitation. Michael Macko said, I realized I couldn't get out from under the collapse. I dove under an ESU truck that was facing north on the west side of West Street. I dove under that and waited for the building to come down. When the building did come down, I actually thought I was trapped. And the truck was blown off me, pushed off me, I guess. It was not there. At that point, I was just really shocked and didn't know what was going on at that point. I didn't know. I was really, really shocked. Similarly, René Davila, we were walking. While we're walking, I realised that we only have two people. I see my vehicle. The seats are covered. I've still got my bag. I hold it like a trophy. People collect basketballs. I haven't touched whatever force was. It was so strong that it went inside of my bag. What is this force that went inside his bag?
South Tower came down. I was across the street, and I picked up the camera just out of habit. And something in the back of my mind said, run, run, run.
Mm, can't hear that.
Okay, yeah, I didn't share the screen audio. What I could do is, if I stop sharing and then start sharing again, you can get the audio. Let's see, hang on. I'm going to start sharing the screen again. I'll try and share the audio as well. Share system audio. See if you can hear this. I'll go back to that in a minute and you can hear it.
South Tower came down. I was across the street, and I picked up the camera just out of habit.
Okay.
And something in the back of my mind said, run, run, run.
That's okay, but basically that face that you saw there is David Hanshaw.
No, it doesn't.
Okay, can you hear me now?
It's not working.
Can you hear me now?
Just hold on 1 second. I can't hear you either.
Can you hear me now?
Yes, there we go.
Okay. So, all right. Just switch that on. So that was David Hanshaw, who was a photographer at the New York Daily News, and he said that he was levitated and carried a block. So we have witness accounts, you know, confirming what we saw in some of the images. This was a stainless steel bar that John was using in his experiments, and we could see.
I've lost your shared screen.
You again? Yeah, I'm just fiddling here. So, okay, is that back again now? You might want to bang that in.
Yeah, it's back.
Okay. So that was on the left was a stainless steel bar that John was using in his experiment. And you can see that parts of that have rusted. It appears to have bits of other stuff in it. Copper, I think, was found in that as well or something. Other elements that shouldn't have been there were in there. And that has some similarity to this truck picture that I showed you earlier on. So again, we've got another similar effect of rusting. Some of John's samples have rusted, like what was seen on 9/11 with some of the samples from there. And we noted it actually when we were there in 2008 that they were still hosing things down. They were hosing down the street, and I videoed them hosing down a sort of long pipe or something. I won't bother playing this clip. So it's like they were still trying to decontaminate the site back then. And then we asked John about this actually, this Bankers Trust building, whereby a piece of material was struck the Bankers Trust from the World Trade Center. It seemed to fly across. And this is actually bent outwards. It's difficult to see unless you look at the picture closely. This damage is bent outwards. So how would something crash into it and then bend it outwards? It's weird. Weird. But what happened to this building was very unusual. Again, you can see in this large up section on the right here, if you look at this very closely, you can see a telephone wire, a coiled telephone wire right down here. Yet here we've got this melted steel girder, but FEMA said in the FEMA report about the disaster there was no fire in the Bankers Trust building. So if there was no fire in that building, how did that girder get that damage? How did it get curled up like that with the paint still on it as well? It's because it was done by some kind of energy. Now, it wasn't directed energy in the form of a directed beam at that particular piece of metal. It was kind of regionalized. It was some type of field effect. That's what Dr. Wood has talked about, field effects. So it was an energy field, a directed energy field, really, is, you know, essentially what we're talking about ultimately in this. And that building then was repaired, and then they took it down piece by piece. Why would you repair a building and took it down? Well, they said it had got a mold infection. Well, perhaps it's because this started happening to it, this severe rusting in the middle. Somehow the building had got affected by the energy which had caused the building materials to start degrading. That's what we think. So the other thing I wanted to talk about, this field effect was something else that Dr. Wood discovered, which is very important. And I don't think people like Jim Fetzer really want to talk about this. And if they do, they tend to deliberately get it wrong. Dr. Judy Wood was looking for more information and data on the dust. So what happened to this dust? Where did the World Trade Center towers go? Well, a proportion of them went into the upper atmosphere. Would you believe? Because the dust became so fine that it went into the upper atmosphere. And then she was finding, for example, that black fumes went to the west, but the white fumes went south. Why was that? She didn't really find an answer to that, I don't think. Maybe she did, and I haven't come across that yet. But what she did find in looking at that picture was this. And this is a really big one. She found Hurricane Erin. And Hurricane Erin was off the coast of New York, about 500 miles away, or at least 500 miles linked to the eye. It was a fair way away. And you could just see it if you were in the right place in Manhattan, just. But you wouldn't have known it was there. Although there was a big thunderstorm the night before 9/11 with quite a lot of rain. But it was a beautiful sunny day, as you're aware, on the day itself. So this is the plume of material from the World Trade Center in the red, in the yellow rectangle here. That's the plume of material from the World Trade Center. And this is Hurricane Erin in the same picture. And they were reporting this hurricane shaped like a pentacle as well. Got like this five-sided shape to it almost. That's just an observation though. But the really important thing to note is what Hurricane Erin did. It's given a name on the 1st of September, and then it travelled across the Atlantic and it hit Bermuda on the 7th of September, where the little blue line is. I think it was a Category 1 storm then, or Category 1 hurricane or something. I haven't memorised all these figures, just the dates really. Then it travelled after it was reported on CNN that it did this damage on 7th September, and then it travelled in a straight line for 4 days, and it was closest to New York City at 8:45 in the morning of 9/11, and then on the 12th it made a right-hand turn and headed out towards Newfoundland. So what was that about? Was that a coincidence? Was that really all it was? It was just a weather coincidence? Well, forgive me, but I don't think it was. So we're into some pretty serious stuff now, really. So you might ask, what's that got to do with energy, Andrew? Well, as you may be aware, there's quite a lot of energy in thunderstorms, isn't there? And there's quite a lot of even more energy in hurricanes. And in fact, as Dr. Judy Wood observed, the three New York airports, JFK, LaGuardia and Newark, they all reported dry thunder on 9/11. In other words, there wasn't a big rain shower, but they heard the sound of thunder, which means that there was some electrical storm activity going on in the vicinity of the airports, somewhere where they could hear it. And that means that the storm system had an influence in Manhattan. And what's in a thunderstorm? Electricity. So I said a while ago that John Hudson was using an electrostatic field from a Van de Graaff generator or a Tesla coil. Well, we argue that this energy system that was deployed employed an electrostatic field, and that electrostatic field was provided by Hurricane Erin, the storm system. So there was energy that they could extract from the electrical field or somehow employ the electrical energy with other intermixed with other energy such as microwaves, such as the Earth's magnetic field, which is there naturally, and maybe some other phase conjugated beam that they've technology that they've got, and that's how they did it. So the energy system wasn't in one place. They were mixing together different sorts of energy fields and then maybe introducing some sort of trigger, some catalyst, some energy catalyst, such as a beam from somewhere, we know not where. Or maybe they had some high-powered magnetic field generator which was highly pulsed, and that was in a briefcase, you know. And as I've said, if you take what John Hutchinson was doing, he was using 2 tons of equipment, which was, some of it was powered by valves, you know, and radio tubes, as some people call them. If you take all that kit and miniaturize it with solid-state electronics, put it under software control, you might fit it in the back of a van or a couple of briefcases or something like that. I don't know. I don't work for the black world. I didn't develop this technology. I'm just guessing. I could be completely wrong. But I'm just, you know, trying to make an educated guess to answer your legitimate questions like yours that you have. But just because we can't answer, you know, we don't know whose weapon it was. We don't know where it was. We don't know who switched it on. We don't know how long it was switched on for. We don't know how much energy was used. We don't know its power source. There's a lot we don't know about it. But just because we don't know those things doesn't mean to say it didn't happen and doesn't mean to say that we're automatically wrong. You know, I say to people, for example, you go out in the morning, you know, and you find your car's been broken into and there's nothing being stolen. You can't say that your car wasn't broken into because you don't know who did it. You don't know where they came from and you don't know how they did it because there's no obvious reason. You just know that your car's been broken into. You don't need to know the motive to demonstrate that something happened a certain way. That's not how things work in the world. So when I tried to put that information out, I think I've got this. Yeah, so I when Dr. Wood had discovered that, I decided to write that up into a little like 800-word article or something. And I tried to post that as a press release on this op-ed news site. I think that's still going, actually. But this character called John Moffat, who claimed to be the science editor, he deleted my press release and he wrote to me and said, Dr. Wood does not follow any of the basic tenets of science, such as performing experiments and collecting data and analysing data. Where are her graphs and tables of data? She is not a scientist, she is a crackpot. I have read Dr. Wood's web pages and they are disorganised, rambling and lack any semblance of scientific data. Really? That's what John Moffat said, who's meant to be a science editor. Why would he say such a thing? My only answer is he wanted to censor the information which I've just been talking about. Now, I managed to put that out in another form, so it didn't really matter. What he did didn't really have much of an effect. And that's not a mainstream news website anyway, you know. But that's what happened, you know. It kept on happening. It's still happening to this day, you know. Dr. Wood highlights some of these examples as well. This is John Hutchinson's metal sample on the right. We can see we've got a stainless steel knife embedded in an aluminium block. How does that happen, folks? You tell me. But that's material changes, and these sorts of material changes seem to happen with tornadoes passing or hurricanes coming nearby, where certain materials seem to end up stuck into other materials. It seems like a physical impossibility, but what we're arguing is that the material structure somehow weakens or becomes less coherent and things can merge together more easily and get conjoined and stuff like that. That's what seems to be happening. Levitation effects again, those are seen with hurricanes and tornadoes, and again, we've seen that picture before.
So, I see you're going to talk about Tesla. Yeah.
So really, that we sort of mentioned that already, but that's again to illustrate. This is a Tesla coil on the left, and this on the middle picture at the bottom is the anatomy of a hurricane, where you get electrical activity at the top, you get charge building up. In other words, it has a vague similarity to the structure of a Tesla coil, yet it's a storm system. So this is what the analogy that Dr. Wood made, you know. Are we exactly right? Well, could well be. We don't know for sure because, of course, nobody's admitted to any of this. We don't have any admission from anybody. What we do know is that Science Applications International Corporation, they're a big defence contractor. They were involved in coordinating the production of the NIST reports, right? And they do research and development into directed energy weapons and psychological operations. So that company is well placed not only to know about what happened on 9/11, but also to cover it up. Okay? And then we have this other evidence, which is important, that Dr. Wood discovered. She was looking at, as we were saying, we're talking about magnetic fields. So she decided to study the Earth's magnetic field and what it was doing on 9/11. And there are these instruments called magnetometers that you can buy. You could probably, in fact, you can get, you have them on your iPhone. Some iPhones have magnetometers, actually, because you can use them to measure the Earth's magnetic field and therefore use it as a compass. And she found a range of data from magnetometers run by, I think, the University of Alaska. And they were looking at how the Earth's magnetic field changed, okay? And she found that there were variations in the Earth's magnetic field coincident with the events of 9/11. And the key one here, really, that she amplified in this Excel trace, that she got the raw data and made an Excel trace, was 846, where you can see that there's been a deflection of the Earth's magnetic field to a sort of low point in this way this is drawn. So it had gone, deflected more to the south or to the north, I'm not sure which. And that lowest deflection was coincident with the appearance of the first hole in World Trade Center number 1. So do you think a plane crash or a nuclear device going off started to affect the Earth's magnetic field 20 minutes before the hole appeared?
Mm-mm.
And then it recovered a bit afterwards? Or do you think it was some sort of energy discharge or energy event? I would strongly argue that that hole was created by some sort of energy event, energy effect. Not a laser beam, not a microwave beam necessarily. It might have been used microwaves, but it was something that affected the Earth's magnetic field. Not only that, it appeared to have been affecting the Earth's magnetic field for about 20 minutes before it happened. So I think this was a black project. And the people that don't want to talk about this and explore this evidence, I think, are dishonest. And that's what I've been talking about since I realised this in mid-2007 and early 2008. And I think I've got some other slides here which really, I think, hammer home that this was a directed energy event because it involves this character. Let's see if I've got a slide about him. Maybe I haven't. Yeah, have I got a slide about him? So the other thing that folks need to be aware of is cold fusion. And let's see. I've got this slide, haven't I? So let me just share this now. You won't be able. I don't need to play the video clip because I can just explain it. So as you may be aware, Jeremy, I've already mentioned that the World Trade Center reports were produced by NIST in August 2005. 10,000 pages of reports were released. Strangely enough, around that same time, a new 9/11 truther appeared, and his name was Stephen E. Jones, who worked at Brigham Young University. And I actually ended up corresponding with him. In fact, he invited me, along with Jim Fetzer, to join the Scholars for 9/11 Truth group in December 2005. And I think I reproduced the emails in my book. I've still got copies of those emails in my archive. So Jones was the one that invited me to join the Scholars for 9/11 Truth group, because I work for the Open University. I've worked for them for over 20 years now. And no, not quite 20 years, actually. Coming up for 20 years. It's actually 20 years now. And that's how come I got invited to the Scholars for 9/11 Truth group, because I work for a university. But where I didn't realise at the time that Jones had a history. Now, Jones had been working in a field of research called low-energy nuclear reactions, to give it a more correct term. But he liked to call it cold fusion. And in fact, it was Stephen E. Jones and his friend Paul Palmer that coined that term, cold fusion, much to the chagrin of the chemists, two world-class chemists, Stanley Pons and Martin Fleischmann, that rediscovered that effect back in the mid-80s. And Anyway, so Stephen A. Jones was actually involved in research called into an effect called muon-catalyzed cold fusion in the 1980s, and he was responsible for voting on a panel which decided to defund Pons and Fleischmann's cold fusion research, and that happened in about 1989, 1990, 1991. That's all documented in the book by Dr. Eugene Malev called Fire from Ice, which you can get. I think it's out of print, but there used to be second-hand copies readily available. So Jones is mentioned on 100 pages of that book. Jones was essentially trying to cover up the fact that you can get energy for free from cold fusion. That's what I think he was doing then. And I think he was put onto the scene of 9/11 research in August 2005 because he knew, as we later discovered, that certain events and effects which are seen in cold fusion experiments are related to some of the effects that I've seen, like transmutation, for example. There's a film that was produced in 1999 called Fire from Water that was produced by Eugene Malev, I think. And that actually has an interview with a chemist from Texas A&M University, John Bockris, and he talked there about how they found elements in their experimental cold fusion cells after running them which shouldn't have been there. For a start, they found tritium. Tritium was also found in high quantities in World Trade Center 6 in water that was taken from there, about, I think, 50,000 times the normal level. And that's the sort of quantity that Bockris was talking about that they discovered in cold fusion experiments. So cold fusion was an area of research which where anomalous nuclear effects were discovered. Molecules and atoms were changing in ways which they couldn't explain. That's what was seen on 9/11. So I put it to you and everyone that Stephen A. Jones knew this, and that's why he was put out onto the 9/11 research scene to direct people away from the evidence, which was what Dr. Judy Wood was producing. I'm just going to clear my throat. I think he knew all about that, and the way that he reacted to us indicated that that was true, that he did know about this. And it turns out that Dr. Judy Wood's student, Michael Zeber, who was murdered in April 2006 in a street mugging, his uncle was called William Zeber. And William Zeber worked with Dr. Eugene Malev in the New Energy Foundation, which was looking at all these anomalous energy effects that people were discovering, like cold fusion. Malev himself was murdered in, I think, April or May 2004, allegedly in a bungled burglary, which was perhaps slightly suspicious, but some people say it was just a terrible, violent burglary that somebody decided to commit and kill him. When Stephen E. Jones discussed this spire image that I showed you, he said that it shakes and falls. No, it didn't shake and fall, Mr. Jones. It turned to dust. So he was trying to cover that, but he didn't want to talk about that. That's just one example. I think I've got another example here that he tried to talk about. Let's see. Then Jones helped to promote the nuke. He said he disagreed with the nuke thing. But this Bill Deagle, he promoted the nuke angle. He started to talk about it as well. That was in 2007.
Andrew, could you bring us in for a landing?
Yeah, by all means. So what we're really talking about, I called it Liars for 9/11 Truth. Because, sadly, there are a lot of liars in the 9/11 Truth movement who won't talk about this. If they do talk about this, they seem to be deliberately getting it wrong. You know, I've tried to correct them and point out, no, that's not true. Mr. Gage was another one, Richard Gage. He says that Judy Wood doesn't talk about bombs in the building. He doesn't talk about thermite. Yes, she does, Mr. Gage, and you should know that she does because I have a check with your name on it which shows that you bought her book, and you look at the contents page of her book and it says what she covers. And you said that she doesn't cover that, yet you own the book, which you bought with architects and engineers' funds. I've got the check that proves that, because somebody else sent it to me. So he can only be a liar for truth. He's lying for truth, as is Steve Nee Jones, as is Jim Fetzer, unfortunately. They're liars for truth. That's what I call them. Yeah, they've censored this discussion, architects and engineers. Oh, I also wanted to show you an article, just very briefly, Jeremy, before I bring us in for a landing. I'm going to try. I think it's important that I show you this article so that you know who you're dealing with. Let's just see if I can get this up. It's not there. I'm just going to take me a minute to get this. I did have this ready earlier on. Oh, there we go. That's it. So I'll put this on the other screen, and then you should be able to see it. So this is an article by... this is what we're accused of by somebody who's been on your program. As you'll see at the top here when I show you the name, this is the 9/11 Scholars Forum. And this was posted by James H. Fetzer on the February the 2nd, 2010. The Judy Wood / John Hutchison Cult, Part 2. So this is a two-parter. I haven't read all of this. I do know this chap, Conrado Salascano. He's a friend of mine. So he's part of the Judy Wood, John Hutchison Cult. Apparently, I think I might even get a mention in here. There we are. Yeah, I get a mention, including Andrew Johnson. So apparently I, Jeremy, am part of the Judy Wood, John Hutchison Cult. Make of that what you will. I just think that's nonsense, you know, basically. And I don't know why this... I mean, Fetzer actually invited me, if you read my book, Fetzer invited me to be on the steering committee of the 9/11 Scholars Group, which he formed when he broke away from Stephen E. Jones. And that was just, to me, just a fake food fight. I pretty much realised that fairly early on. So what have we got then? So we've got the situation... that I don't know if I've got Dr. Wood's closing slide here, but maybe I'll go to one of the slides at the end of my talk here. This is quite a good one. This was done by somebody else. I'll leave this up just while I'm talking because you can get a bit of fun out of this, I think. So what we've got is basically some sort of directed energy weapon system was used to destroy the World Trade Center. That's a fact. It's not a theory. That's what the evidence proves and shows. All these other people who are talking about nukes or planes or whatever it is, if they haven't sat down and studied the evidence that I've shown you, which is plain and simple in its basic form, relatively simple, I hope that you've understood it, I hope your listeners have understood it, then to me, really, they're just being dishonest. As simple as that. They need to accept what happened, that this is what happened, that the buildings turned to dust before they hit the ground. That cannot be explained by any conventional mechanism such as bombs, nukes, hot nukes, cold nukes, mini nukes, big nukes, micro nukes, demolition nukes, thermite, thermate, fluoride, which is what what's the name, Sophia Smallstorm came out with. It's some sort of energy weapon system, and it's a system which isn't, there's not much information about it in the white world. The system itself has some similarity to the system that John Hutchison has used, which is kind of a homespun thing that he did. But again, look at the documents. He was investigated by the Pentagon. You know, he sent me an email the other day, which he was sending to somebody in the Pentagon that he knows. He was investigated by the Canadian government. He's got a document from a letter from Canadian MP Chuck Cook saying that they had done a report on his research and then classified that report. I've got those documents on my website for anybody that wants to see them. We took this to court. Yet you've got all these other clowns, like on this picture, Richard Gay, Stephen E. Jones, Alex Jones, all these other people saying, no, it wasn't Judy Wood. Judy Wood's an idiot. It wasn't directed energy weapons. That's just disinformation. They're trying to bring the truth movement into disrepute and that we're not going to talk about anything to do with energy. So what we've shown really is that this energy can do incredible things. It can levitate people. What does that mean? Well, it means we can use it for propulsion. We can use it to create energy from no fuel. We can use it to desalinate water, create as much water from seawater. We can use it to mitigate the effects of harmful radiation. If you've got free energy, you can do anything. You can create as much rubbish as you want, toxic rubbish, and then just use a process to make that rubbish and material harmless again, because you know how to change it at molecular level. You can travel to the stars, right? That's what you can do with this technology. Or you can use it to control the world, turn things to dust, deform cars, kill people. You can use it for that. I know which I choose, you know, and I know what I'd rather talk about than not talk about. Now, again, if I'm wrong about this, you know, please tell me, where have I gone wrong? What's wrong? You know, Dr. Judy Wood would say the same. What is wrong with what we've shown you? Where did we go wrong? Tell us. Don't insult us. Tell us what we got wrong. Correct us. Make it better. Improve it. We want to get closer to the truth. That is all we want. We don't want fame. We don't want fortune. We don't want money. We want to know what happened. We want to tell people what happened, right? Help us. Help us make it better. Nobody's doing that, Jeremy. Nobody's doing that. You know, they just want to insult us, or by and large, or say that we're wrong. So, you know, you work that one out, because I can't. So there it is, really. I mean, you know, people say, just one question that comes up, I'll try and address this. Has the weapon been used since? Oh, this is what some of the people that visited our website between, I don't know, 2007 and 2008, we had them all come to our websites when I was tracking these, the Air Force, the Army, Boeing, SAIC, Los Alamos National Labs, they came to our website. They all came and had a look, you know. Why do you want to poke around these crappy old websites by these two nutters, you know? Well, we know why. So people say, was the weapon used again? Well, another area of investigation is the Alfred P. Murrah building. Dr. Wood has mentioned, has talked about that a little bit. I've done a little post about the Alfred P. Murrah building, which was the site of the Oklahoma City bombing in 1995. We suspect that that was probably a use of some form of this weapon too, because there were toasted cars there, and that some of the damage was quite similar. Then I came across this article a few years ago. I think Dr. Wood sent me this picture, or maybe it was Morgan Reynolds sent me this picture. This was from 2007. August the 10th, 2007 was the left-hand picture. This was in, I think, Syria. It was a facility in Syria. I don't know what this facility was. Maybe it was some type of secret development facility for a nuclear reactor or something like that. And then by October the 24th, this building had completely disappeared. It looked like the site had been wiped clean. Now, maybe it had just been taken down. I don't know. But I think there was some proposal on that. There's an article about that. I don't have time to show that here. But so maybe it has been used again. But look at what they're doing with the weather. If they can steer hurricanes, they can create a climate change hoax, can't they? I mean, I'm putting it very simply, but I think they can. So this affects all the climate change nonsense as well. That's how important this is, because they're able to manipulate the weather, I would argue, and steer hurricanes, maybe even create them from scratch for all I know. As Dr. Wood says, she would argue that this technology could be used to split the Earth in half, right? Maybe she's right. Maybe she's right. So, you know, let's be ready for the fake alien invasion. We haven't even talked about the planes and how they were created with some sort of 3D image projection technology. Richard D. Hall and Mark Conlon have talked a lot about that. So they've got all the technology they need for the fake alien invasion, which they've started to talk about a bit more now, haven't they? You know, I'll just show you another, while we get onto that. And again, this is sort of finishing up really, but if I just try and show you the thing that came onto my screen a couple of weeks ago, you'll see this is a fairly ancient, this is a fairly recent posting. Oh gosh, can I find it? Maybe I can't. No, I can't, I don't think. But there was they've been putting out stories now about alien, getting in contact with aliens and stuff, and things like this. So if we say that the images from the planes were actually holograms, and we saw what happened to the World Trade Center, we compare that to what we saw in the Independence Day film in 1996, where we had a flying saucer over the Empire State Building, blew it apart. Let's change the holographic images of planes for the sake of argument, or say they're holograms or something like that. Let's change those plane images to flying saucers, one or more, like on Independence Day. And let's take down the new replacement of the World Trade Center, Freedom Tower, whatever it's called, or the Burj Khalifa in Dubai or somewhere. you've got your fake alien invasion right there, haven't you? So that's what I think, you know, is a potential landing point for this, you know. But maybe I'm just crazy. You know, people can make their own decision on that. So I think that really brings us to some sort of finishing point. Yeah, in fact,
good morning, my name is...
Yeah, so I've got that video clip there. I've got if you look for that on the last card on my YouTube channel, you'll find that video. War on Terror is fake. We know that. Whoever controls the energy supply controls the destiny of the human race. Climate change story is bogus, as I've said. That's all nonsense. You know, they've known that. Some people know this anyway for other reasons, not just because of what I've shown you about Hurricane Erin and stuff. It's all just misdirection and a scam. People know this. I think people in the truth movement, Alex Jones probably knows what I'm telling you is true. Stephen E. Jones almost certainly knows that what I'm telling you is true. Probably Jim Fetzer does. I've put that in my books. He's never denied it, but he just wants to ignore me. So I don't know. Let him ignore me. I don't care. All these groups, you know, Amnesty International, Stop the War, all of those things, they're just irrelevant to me now, really, because they don't want to. They have no interest in investigating this evidence. That would make them. They would have to completely change their direction if they were honest about what I've shown you. All of them would, you know. The media is covering this up. I mean, they're going down now. I think people have realised, a lot more people, not enough people, but a lot more people have realised that the mainstream media, they're just a mouthpiece. They're not going to give you the important information like we've shown you tonight. So just switch them off. Ignore them. Mm-hmm. Delete them from your favourites. Don't look at them. And when their advertising revenue drops away, then maybe they will disappear. But, of course, the powers that be are still going to pump their resources into them to keep them going for as long as they can. There's the book. You can get copies from me if anybody wants that. You don't need to buy it. There's plenty of videos. There's Dr. Judy Wood's website. My books are free in electronic form. You can download all of those. They've got more background to some of this. And so there you are. Richard D. Hall's website is very good. He's got a lot of this on there as well, and some background information, which is difficult to find in other places. He's done a very good investigation into the plane crashes, quote unquote, on his website as well. So I recommend you take a look at that if you're interested. So there you are. I think we can wrap it up with that for now. I don't know if you've got any other follow-up questions or anything.
Andrew, it is a lot to take in.
Absolutely.
I must admit, it is a phenomenal conversation. I appreciate your time immensely. I think when I edit this, I'm going to have to just go through it slowly.
Sure.
But it is highly persuasive. There's no doubt about that.
Yeah, well, that, you know, absolutely. And I'm not trying to persuade anybody, really. Obviously, I'm quite forthright and direct in how I present and state things, but I feel I've got the confidence of the evidence behind me that nobody in, you know, I've been talking about this stuff for 15 years and none of it has ever been challenged, really, not in any serious or meaningful way. So I'm confident that this is the correct picture and correct interpretation of the evidence.
All right. Well, let's come in then for a final question. I ask all my guests this. You're standing on the battleground of the information war and you look out at the horizon. What is it that you see?
I see a lot of people who don't have a lot of humility and they want to make the same mistakes, for example, that politicians do. Politicians are a group of people that don't ever admit they were wrong and want to try and put a spin on things. Many more people are like that. And their thinking and their behaviour is controlled by their unwillingness to accept mistakes that they have made either themselves or misunderstandings that they've had for a long time. So that's what I see looking out in that way. And I don't know what the answer is to get around that except for people just maybe doing a bit of reflection in their own time, in their own way, and trying to work out if what they are saying is actually true, and trying to constantly reevaluate that and accept any new information which comes to them and can be confirmed, that would fundamentally change the way they think about the world itself, or their own lives, or their own relationships, or even the science that they've been taught, things like that.
Andrew Johnson, wow, that was a phenomenal conversation. Thank you for joining me in the trenches.
You're welcome. Thanks for inviting me.